You are listening to This Week in Palestine, Truth and Justice Radio, WZBC, Boston College. Today is Sunday, July 5th, 2026. Before we step into this hour, a brief reminder for our listeners. The reflections you hear today rise from the voices of our hosts and guests alone. They are shaped by their experiences, their convictions, and their search for truth. They do not represent the official views of WZBC, Boston College, or its Board of Trustees. What you hear in this space is unfiltered. What you hear in this space is honest. What you hear in this space belongs to the people who speak it. And now, with that clarity set before us, we begin. This Week in Palestine is not a place where truth tiptoes. It does not wait at the doorway or ask permission to enter. Here, truth walks in with its shoulders squared, its voice steady, its presence undeniable. Urgency is not an accessory in this space. It is the pulse that drives every word, every story, every breath we take behind this microphone. Clarity is not a choice. It is the duty we accept the moment we speak to you. And while our heart beats in Palestine, in the alleys of Jerusalem, in the camps of the West Bank, in the shattered streets of Gaza, our sight reaches far beyond the borders drawn by occupation or diplomacy. Because the forces shaping Palestinian life do not stop at walls or wire. They move through parliaments, through boardrooms, through the quiet corridors, where powerful hands make decisions that ordinary people must live with. Wherever you are listening now, steering through the long dark hours of your shift, lifting your first cup of coffee into the morning air, or sitting in the stillness of your home, thank you for choosing to be here. I am your host and narrator, James Kent. In this space, we do not sand down the truth to make it easier to swallow. We do not bend the story to comfort those who prefer silence. We do not dilute reality for the sake of anyone's convenience. Here, truth stands unfiltered. Resistance is not theory. It is breath. It is survival. Solidarity is not a slogan. It is a lineage carried from one generation to the next. The voices rising from occupied land do not waver. They rise alongside movements across the world that demand dignity, justice, and liberation. They remind us that struggle is never solitary. It is woven across borders, across histories, across the lives of people who refuse to surrender their humanity. This hour is not just a broadcast. It is a lifeline, a thread stretching from Palestine to every corner of the globe, binding devastation to determination, binding grief to a future still worth reaching for. Even in the deepest darkness, the spark of defiance endures. Even when the world turns away, that spark refuses to die. Each week, we bring you reporting that cuts through distortion, analysis that refuses disguise, and reflections that center Palestinian life in all its depth, complexity, and unbroken courage. We speak with intention because the stakes demand nothing less. This Week in Palestine is not a refuge for polite silence. It is testimony. It is urgency. It is solidarity without hesitation. The struggle for freedom is shared. It crosses borders, and it remains sacred. I hope you all had a happy and safe 4th of July, a day that, for many Americans, is wrapped in fireworks, family gatherings, and the familiar rhythm of celebration. A day that symbolizes independence, the birth of a nation, and the promise of freedom. A day when streets fill with parades, when flags rise across neighborhoods, when children learn the stories of revolution and courage. A day that reminds Americans of the sacrifices made by those who fought for liberty, for self-determination, for the right to live without tyranny. A day that speaks to the American imagination, the belief that freedom is not just a privilege, but a birthright. A day that celebrates the idea that a nation can rise from oppression and declare its own destiny. A day that honors the belief that all people are created equal, endowed with rights that no government should ever take away. A day that, at its core, is supposed to represent justice, dignity, and the courage to stand against empire. A day that tells Americans, this is who we are supposed to be. But today we must confront a difficult truth. How do we celebrate the 4th of July while we are causing wars across the world? How do we raise flags and speak of freedom when our own government has undermined the freedom of so many others? How do we honor independence while supporting policies that strip independence from entire nations? How do we celebrate when we are the ones who invaded Venezuela, destabilized its government, and took its president and his wife as prisoners? How do we celebrate when our foreign policy has left scars across Latin America that still bleed today? How do we celebrate the 4th of July when we have fueled chaos in the Middle East and the Gulf? When our decisions have contributed to wars that have destroyed cities, displaced millions, and shattered generations? When we have supported Israel in its genocide in Gaza, its attacks on Lebanon, its occupation, its siege, its endless war? How do we celebrate freedom while enabling oppression? How do we celebrate independence while supporting occupation? How do we celebrate justice while funding injustice? Sometimes I think, maybe it's better if we don't celebrate this day anymore. Not because the ideals are wrong, the ideals are beautiful, but because we have betrayed them. Maybe it is better to pause, to reflect, to ask ourselves what freedom really means, to ask ourselves whether we still deserve to celebrate it, to ask ourselves whether the fireworks and parades are hiding a truth we refuse to face. Because the 4th of July is supposed to be a day of honesty, a day of courage, a day of remembering what America claimed to stand for. And if we cannot live up to those ideals, if we cannot stop causing wars, stop supporting oppression, stop enabling genocide, then maybe the celebration has become a lie. Maybe the real way to honor the 4th of July is not with fireworks, but with accountability, not with parades, but with truth. Not with patriotic speeches, but with a commitment to stop harming the world in the name of power. Maybe the real celebration begins when America finally decides to live up to the values it teaches its children. And until that day comes, the question remains, what does independence mean if we deny it to everyone else? I'm James Kent, and you're listening to This Week in Palestine, Truth and Justice Radio, WZBC, Boston College. We ask this question many times, but we keep coming back to ask again. Why does Israel keep attacking Lebanon today, even though every peace process, every ceasefire proposal, every diplomatic roadmap clearly states that stopping the attacks on Lebanon is a basic requirement for stability? Why does Israel insist on burning the fields, striking the villages, and escalating the northern front, even as the region is trying to avoid a wider war? To answer that, we need to look beyond Lebanon's border, because the fire in Lebanon is tied to a much bigger shift, a shift happening in the Red Sea, in the Gulf, and across the maritime routes that define global power. While Israel escalates in Lebanon, Yemen and Iran are quietly rewriting the rules of naval warfare. And the United States, for the meantime, finds its fleet caught in a trap it never expected. For decades, the American fleet was the symbol of global dominance. Massive carriers, endless firepower, unchallenged control of the seas. But today, that model is cracking. The US Navy is being forced to abandon the old doctrine of heavy carrier presence and shift towards smaller, flexible, mission-specific naval groups. Why? Because the threats have changed. Because the battlefield has changed. Because Yemen and Iran have changed the game. The American fleet is no longer facing traditional navies. It is facing asymmetric warfare. Drones, mines, coastal missiles, and geography used as a weapon. The old naval order is collapsing. The Strait of Hormuz is not just a waterway. It is the most strategic choke point on Earth. And Iran has transformed it into a tactical maze. Iran is not trying to control the sea. It is trying to deny the sea, a strategy designed to make navigation dangerous, unpredictable, and costly for the United States. Iran uses mines, drones, coastal missile batteries, radar networks, island-based choke points. It has even changed the shipping routes, forcing vessels to request permission before crossing. This is not just military pressure. It is an attempt to impose a new legal reality. Hormuz has become a trap, not because Iran wants war, but because it wants leverage, and the United States knows it. While Iran reshapes Hormuz, Yemen is reshaping the Red Sea. The Yemeni armed forces have developed a new form of naval warfare, one that relies on long-range drones, anti-ship missiles, coastal launchers, intelligence networks, surprise strikes. These tools have forced the US Navy to reposition carriers, reroute shipping, and adopt a new doctrine of selective strikes instead of large-scale operations. American analysts call this the shift toward comfortable hunting, targeted, intelligence-driven strikes meant to avoid escalation. But the truth is simpler. The US fleet is adapting because it is vulnerable. Yemen has turned the Red Sea into a battlefield where American dominance is no longer guaranteed. The United States is now caught between two fires: Hormuz in the east, the Red Sea in the west. Iran denies the sea. Yemen disrupts the sea. The American fleet is forced to move carriers constantly, rely on smaller ships, avoid predictable routes, respond to drone threats, manage political pressure, prevent escalation. This is not the behavior of a dominant navy. This is the behavior of a navy trying to avoid being dragged into a war it cannot control. The trap is not physical, it is strategic. The US fleet is trapped in a new era of naval warfare, one defined by asymmetric threats and regional actors who understand the geography better than Washington ever did. So what does all this have to do with Israel's attacks on Lebanon? Everything. Israel sees the American fleet struggling. Israel sees Washington recalibrating. Israel sees Iran gaining leverage. Israel sees Yemen disrupting global routes. Israel sees the old American umbrella weakening. And when Israel feels the umbrella weakening, it escalates. Lebanon becomes the pressure valve, the place where Israel tries to reassert dominance, the place where Israel sends messages to Iran, to Washington, and to the region. Israel attacks Lebanon today because it fears losing strategic relevance tomorrow. For years, Washington sold the region a story that the US Navy could protect shipping, contain Iran, deter Yemen, and maintain stability. But today, that story is collapsing. The American fleet is repositioning. Its carriers are overstretched. Its doctrine is changing. Its dominance is challenged. The deception, the illusion of total control, is gone. And Israel feels the collapse. So it lashes out in Lebanon. For the meantime, the region is changing faster than Israel can adapt. Iran is rising. Yemen is asserting itself. The Gulf is recalibrating. The United States is distracted. Russia and China are expanding influence. Israel is no longer the center of the regional equation. It is a player in a game it no longer controls. So it attacks Lebanon to remind the world it still has teeth. But the world sees something else. a state lashing out because it is losing its grip. But while states play games, people pay the price. Lebanese families live under constant threat. Farmers lose their land. Children lose their homes. Communities lose their safety. Israel's attacks do not change the naval balance. They do not weaken Iran. They do not deter Yemen. They only deepen suffering, and Israel knows this. But for the meantime, it continues. Today, we saw how the Lebanon trap, the Hormuz fire, Yemen's naval rise, and the collapse of American maritime dominance all connect to one simple truth. Israel keeps attacking Lebanon not because peace is impossible, but because instability serves its strategy. This is not the Middle East of yesterday. This is the Middle East of today. I am James Kent, and you are listening to This Week in Palestine. Now let's try to understand something nobody ever talks about it, including Palestinians. The price paid when leadership becomes a position instead of a responsibility. Today, across Palestine and the diaspora, a question echoes louder than ever. What is the cost of a failed Palestinian leadership? Not in slogans, not in abstractions, but in the lived reality of a people enduring occupation, fragmentation, and political paralysis. This segment examines how decades of internal division, stalled institutions, and unaccountable governance have shaped the Palestinian struggle. It is not a judgment of individuals, but an exploration of systems, decisions, and consequences, as described by analysts, historians, and civil society voices who have documented this story for years. Listeners should confirm details with trusted sources. In the early 1990s, many Palestinians believed they were witnessing the dawn of a new era. Negotiations, international recognition, and the establishment of the Palestinian Authority were framed as steps toward sovereignty. But as researchers and political historians have noted, the institutions built during that period were fragile from the start. They were designed under occupation. They depended on external funding. They lacked democratic continuity, and they were never allowed full authority over land, borders, or movement. Over time, the gap between the promise and the reality widened. Analysts point to three structural weaknesses: centralized power concentrated in a small circle of political elites, absence of elections, leaving leadership without renewed legitimacy, dependence on foreign donors, shaping priorities and limiting autonomy. These weaknesses didn't appear overnight. They accumulated slowly, becoming part of the political landscape. By 2007, the political rupture between Gaza and the West Bank created two competing governments, two security structures, and two visions for the future. Scholars often describe this moment as one of the most damaging turning points in modern Palestinian politics. The cost of that split is visible everywhere. Governance paralysis. Laws passed in one territory do not apply in the other. Fragmented representation. No unified voice in negotiations or international forums. Social division. Families, institutions, and communities caught between rival authorities. Economic collapse, especially in Gaza, where blockade and political isolation deepened poverty. Civil society organizations repeatedly warn that this division has weakened the Palestinian national project more than any external actor could have done alone. When leadership fails, ordinary people carry the burden. In the West Bank, residents describe daily life shaped by checkpoints, settlement expansion, and unpredictable security coordination. Many argue that coordination, originally intended to stabilize the region, has instead become a tool that limits Palestinian agency. In Gaza, the cost is measured in destroyed homes, restricted movement, and repeated wars. Humanitarian agencies report that the blockade, combined with political stagnation, has left generations without stable employment, reliable electricity, or access to medical care. Across refugee camps in Lebanon, Jordan, and Syria, families speak of decades spent waiting for a political horizon that never arrives. The cost is not theoretical. It is lived in every restriction, every demolished home, every stalled opportunity. Diplomats and analysts often note that Palestinian leadership has struggled to adapt to shifting global politics. While international support for Palestinian rights remains widespread, the diplomatic strategy has been inconsistent. Some observers argue that the leadership relies too heavily on symbolic victories in international bodies. It has not built strong alliances with emerging global powers. It has failed to present a unified, modern political vision that resonates beyond the region. Others counter that the leadership is constrained by occupation, limited resources, and geopolitical pressure. Both perspectives highlight the same outcome. Palestinians remain without a clear, effective diplomatic strategy capable of advancing their national aspirations. Palestinians have not voted in national elections since 2006. For many, this is the clearest sign of political failure. Without elections, leadership cannot renew its mandate. Institutions cannot evolve. Youth, now the majority of the population, have no political pathway. Corruption becomes harder to challenge. Public trust erodes. Civil society groups repeatedly call for democratic renewal, arguing that no liberation movement can survive without accountability. They warn that the absence of elections has created a leadership disconnected from the people it claims to represent. Despite political stagnation, a new generation of Palestinians is emerging. Activists, journalists, organizers, and community leaders who refuse to accept the status quo. They are not waiting for permission. They are not waiting for institutions to reform themselves. They are building networks, documenting abuses, organizing protests, and shaping global narratives. Their message is clear. Leadership must reflect the people, not the other way around. Many analysts believe this generation will eventually redefine Palestinian politics, but the transition will be difficult. Old structures rarely give way easily. The cost of failed leadership is not only political, it is emotional, it is psychological, it is generational. It looks like a child in Gaza who has lived through multiple wars before turning 10, a farmer in the West Bank watching settlements expand onto his land, a refugee in Lebanon who has never seen the homeland, a student in Ramallah who dreams of elections that never come. A family in Jerusalem navigating residency laws designed to push them out. These stories are not the result of one decision or one leader. They are the cumulative impact of decades of fragmentation, mismanagement, and unaccountable governance, combined with the ongoing reality of occupation. Political analysts emphasize that responsibility is shared across multiple actors: local leadership, regional powers, international governments, and the occupying state. But within Palestinian society, the conversation about internal responsibility is growing louder. Many Palestinians argue that leadership must rebuild institutions, hold elections, end the split between Gaza and the West Bank, prioritize national unity over factional interests, restore trust through transparency and accountability. Others caution that internal reform alone cannot overcome occupation. They argue that external pressure, military control, and geopolitical dynamics limit what any Palestinian leadership can achieve. Both perspectives agree on one point: the current path is unsustainable. Today, Palestinians face one of the most challenging periods in their modern history. The cost of failed leadership is visible in every corner of life, from governance to diplomacy, from social cohesion to national identity. But the story is not finished. Across Palestine and the diaspora, voices are rising, demanding accountability, demanding unity, demanding a leadership worthy of the people's resilience. The future of the Palestinian struggle will not be determined solely by external forces. It will also be shaped by the choices made within, by the willingness to confront failure, rebuild institutions, and imagine a political horizon rooted in dignity and collective purpose. This is not a story of despair, it is a story of reckoning, and perhaps a story of renewal. Now we explore a moment the region rarely pauses to examine. A confrontation not on the battlefield, but inside the halls of power. A moment when American generals resisted a presidential order, and Iran imposed a new equation that reshaped calculations from Washington to Tel Aviv. This is not a story of heroes or villains. It is a story of pressure, fear, strategy, and the limits of military power. It is a story of how decisions made far from Palestine still carve their way into Palestinian lives. According to multiple analysts and media reports, the crisis began when President Donald Trump pushed for a rapid, large-scale ground escalation in the region. The goal, as described by commentators, was to project overwhelming force and deter Iran. But inside the Pentagon, senior military leaders reportedly pushed back. Not quietly, not symbolically, directly. They warned that a ground invasion would ignite a regional firestorm, stretch US forces thin, and trigger retaliation across multiple fronts. Some analysts say the generals feared the plan lacked clear objectives and underestimated Iran's capabilities. The tension revealed a rare moment, the military establishment resisting the commander-in-chief, not out of politics, but out of strategic calculation. Military experts point to several reasons behind the pushback. Iran's asymmetric power, a network of allies and armed groups capable of striking US bases across the region. Unpredictable escalation. Once a ground invasion begins, controlling its trajectory becomes nearly impossible. A domestic fatigue. After decades of war, the American public has little appetite for another prolonged conflict. Strategic ambiguity, unclear end goals, unclear exit strategy, unclear political horizon. Generals reportedly argued that a ground invasion would not weaken Iran. It would strengthen its narrative and unify its allies. Their resistance was not ideological. It was mathematical. The cost outweighed the gain. While Washington debated internally, Iran moved externally. Analysts describe Iran's strategy as a pressure equation. No ground invasion without consequences. No escalation without response. No attack without a counterattack. Iran signaled through diplomatic channels, military posturing, and regional allies that any ground operation would trigger a multi-front confrontation. Not symbolic, not limited. Full scale. This posture forced Washington to reconsider. It also forced Israel to recalculate its own plans, especially as tensions rose across Gaza, Lebanon, Syria, and the Red Sea. Iran was not seeking war, according to regional experts. It was seeking deterrence, and it succeeded. The standoff between Trump and his generals did not happen in isolation. It rippled across the region. In Lebanon, analysts noted increased readiness among armed groups aligned with Iran. In Iraq, US bases heightened alert levels. In the Gulf, governments braced for potential missile exchanges. In Israel, political leaders watched closely, aware that any American miscalculation could drag them into a broader conflict. And in Palestine, the implications were immediate. A US-Iran confrontation would overshadow Palestinian issues, delay diplomatic efforts, and deepen instability. It would shift global attention away from occupation, away from Gaza's humanitarian crisis, away from the daily realities Palestinians face. Once again, Palestinians found themselves at the mercy of decisions made far beyond their borders. Inside Washington, the confrontation exposed a deeper divide. The difference between political ambition and military reality. presidents often seek decisive action. Generals often seek sustainable outcomes. Trump's push for a ground escalation reflected a desire to project strength. The general's resistance reflected decades of experience in conflicts where strength alone was not enough. This moment highlighted a truth analysts often repeat. Wars are easy to start. They are nearly impossible to control. The Pentagon's refusal was not defiance. It was caution born from history. Iran's response was not impulsive. It was calculated. Experts describe Iran's strategy as patient deterrence. Avoid direct war. Signal readiness. Use regional alliances to expand influence. Force adversaries to think twice. By imposing its equation, Iran demonstrated that it could shape American decision-making without firing a shot. This was not a victory in the traditional sense. It was leverage. And leverage, in today's Middle East, is often more powerful than firepower. For Palestinians, the standoff between Trump and his generals is more than a geopolitical headline. It means delays in diplomatic initiatives that could have supported Palestinian rights, shifts in regional alliances that affect Gaza, the West Bank, and Jerusalem, increased volatility that complicates humanitarian efforts, a renewed focus on Iran that sidelines Palestinian issues in global forums. Palestinians often watch global powers negotiate their futures without Palestinian voices in the room. This moment was another example. The region's largest decisions continue to unfold above Palestinian heads, yet land directly on Palestinian lives. Analysts highlight several lessons from this confrontation. Military institutions can restrain political escalation. Iran's deterrence strategy is more influential than many expected. Regional stability is fragile, shaped by decisions made in Washington and Tehran. Palestinians remain vulnerable to external conflicts they did not choose. The standoff did not produce a war, but it revealed how close the region came to one. Today, as the region navigates uncertainty, the story of American generals resisting a presidential order and Iran imposing its equation remains a reminder of how fragile stability truly is. It shows that power is not only measured in armies or weapons, it is measured in restraint, calculation, and the willingness to avoid catastrophe. For Palestinians, the lesson is familiar. Global powers shape the landscape, but the consequences are felt at home. This is not a story of conflict, it is a story of brinkmanship and the thin line between escalation and survival. I'm James Kent, and you are listening to This Week in Palestine, Truth and Justice Radio, WZBC, Boston College. Now let's begin with a message crafted to travel faster than missiles. A declaration meant to shake Tehran, unsettle Washington, and remind the region that Israel still believes it can redraw the map with a single decision. A message that doesn't whisper, doesn't warn, doesn't negotiate. It announces itself like a spark thrown into dry grass, because Israel is moving today with a level of carelessness that feels deliberate. Careless about what could happen next. Careless about the chain reaction a single strike could unleash. Careless about the fact that Washington, even under Trump, has been urging de-escalation, warning that one miscalculation could ignite a regional firestorm no one can control. But Israel isn't listening. Not to allies, not to analysts, not to the quiet panic spreading through diplomatic channels. What matters now, according to observers, is political survival. The belief that projecting overwhelming force can buy time, buy legitimacy, buy another day in power. And that belief is shaping every threat, every leak, every coded message behind blue and white operation. This is the kind of moment where strategy becomes theater, and theater becomes danger. Israel is signaling that it is willing to light up the entire region if that's what it takes to maintain its political footing. Israel wants a war because it wants the illusion of control, the image of a state that can strike first, strike hard, and dictate the terms of tomorrow. And that's what they are planning to do. Create a spectacle of readiness so intense that it overshadows the consequences. A spectacle designed to force Iran into a corner, to pressure Washington into alignment, and to remind every regional actor that Israel still sees itself as the central axis of Middle Eastern power. But beneath the noise lies a quieter truth, one that Palestinians know too well. When powerful states gamble with regional stability, the fallout rarely lands on the decision makers. It lands on ordinary people, on families already living under occupation, on communities already navigating uncertainty, on a region already stretched thin by conflict, sanctions, and political paralysis. So today, as Israel pushes forward with blue and white operation, the question is not whether the threat is real. The question is, what happens when a state acts as if consequences are optional, as if escalation is a tool, as if lighting the region on fire is a legitimate path to political survival? This is the moment we begin with. A moment where one declaration, one threat, one operation name becomes the center of gravity for an entire region holding its breath. Let's now examine the moment of escalating tension. A moment when Israel signals a possible strike on Iran. Iran responds with strict conditions, and Washington finds itself caught between two adversaries whose next moves could reshape the entire region. This is not a story of predictions. It is a story of pressure, messaging, and brinkmanship. A story of how threats become tools, how conditions become warnings, and how every shift in regional power dynamics eventually lands on Palestinian lives. According to analysts and media reports, Israeli officials began circulating the term blue and white operation, a coded reference to a potential military operation targeting Iranian assets. The message was clear. Israel was preparing for the possibility of a strike as early as tomorrow. This announcement was not made in isolation. It followed weeks of rising tension, intelligence leaks, and political pressure within Israel's security establishment. Experts say the operation's name, drawn from Israel's national colors, was chosen deliberately. It signals national resolve, unity, and readiness for confrontation. But behind the symbolism lies a deeper reality. Israel is attempting to deter Iran, reassure its allies, and project strength at a moment when regional dynamics are shifting rapidly. Analysts point to several factors driving Israel's escalation. Iran's expanding regional influence, especially through allied groups in Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and Yemen. Concerns over Iranian military capabilities, including missile development and drone technology. Internal Israeli politics, where leaders often use external threats to consolidate support. A pressure from Washington, which seeks to contain Iran without committing to a full-scale confrontation. Israel's message is not only directed at Tehran, it is directed at Washington, signaling that Israel may act independently if it feels its security is at risk. This dynamic creates a dangerous equation. Israel threatens action. Iran prepares reaction. Washington fears escalation. Iran did not remain silent. According to regional analysts, Tehran issued strict conditions, not as concessions, but as warnings. Conditions that effectively say, if Israel strikes, Iran will respond. If Washington supports the strike, Iran will widen the confrontation. If regional allies join the escalation, Iran will activate multiple fronts. These conditions are not rhetorical. They are strategic signals designed to deter Israel and pressure Washington. Iran's message is simple. Deterrence through clarity, retaliation through certainty. And Washington, according to observers, is deeply concerned. Inside the US government, analysts describe a growing fear. A single Israeli strike could trigger a regional conflict that Washington is not prepared to manage. The dilemma is clear. If Washington supports Israel, it risks a confrontation with Iran. If Washington restrains Israel, it risks political backlash from its closest regional ally. If Washington stays neutral, it risks losing influence over both sides. This moment exposes a truth often overlooked. The United States is powerful, but not always in control. Regional actors, Israel and Iran, are shaping the battlefield, and Washington is reacting rather than directing. For Palestinians, this dynamic is familiar. Global powers negotiate their interests, while Palestinian realities remain vulnerable to every shift. The threat of blue and white operation reverberates across the Middle East. In Lebanon, analysts report heightened alert among armed groups aligned with Iran. In Syria, military positions shift in anticipation of potential Israeli airstrikes. In Iraq, U.S. bases increase security measures. In the Gulf, governments brace for possible missile exchanges. And in Palestine, the implications are immediate. A confrontation between Israel and Iran would overshadow Palestinian issues, delay humanitarian efforts, and deepen instability in Gaza and the West Bank. It would shift global attention away from occupation, away from settlement expansion, away from the daily struggles Palestinians face. Once again, Palestinians find themselves living under the shadow of decisions made far beyond their borders. Experts describe the current moment as a war of signals. Israel signals readiness. Iran signals deterrence. Washington signals caution. Each actor is trying to shape the other's behavior without crossing the threshold into open conflict. This is the essence of brinkmanship. Push the opponent to the edge, but do not fall over. The danger lies in miscalculation. A single misinterpreted message, a single unintended strike, a single escalation that spirals beyond control. For Palestinians, the threat of an Israeli-Iranian confrontation is not an abstract geopolitical headline. It means increased military presence across the West Bank, heightened tension in Gaza, where any regional conflict could trigger local escalation, delays in diplomatic initiatives that support Palestinian rights, reduced international focus on humanitarian crises, greater unpredictability in Israeli political behavior. Palestinians often live at the intersection of regional conflicts they did not choose. This moment is another example. The region's largest decisions continue to unfold above Palestinian heads, yet land directly on Palestinian lives. Here we can highlight several lessons from this unfolding crisis. Threats can be as powerful as actions. Iran's deterrent strategy is more influential than many expected. Israel's security doctrine remains rooted in preemptive signaling. Washington's influence is limited when regional actors act independently. Palestinians remain vulnerable to external conflicts that reshape their environment. The operation may never be launched, but the threat itself has already changed regional calculations. Today, as the region stands on the edge of uncertainty, the story of blue and white operation reveals how fragile stability truly is. It shows that power is not only measured in armies or weapons, it is measured in messaging, deterrence, and the willingness to avoid catastrophe. For Palestinians, the lesson is clear. Regional conflicts may begin elsewhere, but their consequences always arrive at home. This is not a story of war. It is a story of brinkmanship and the thin line between threat and explosion. I'm James Kent, and you are listening to This Week in Palestine. Let's discuss something else. Let's talk how we are about to enter a moment where regional power is shifting faster than headlines can capture. A moment when Turkey delivers a diplomatic slap that echoes across NATO. When American officials privately admit Israel has become a global burden. And when Saudi Arabia quietly rewrites the strategic map of the Horn of Africa. This is not a story of isolated events. It is a story of tectonic movement, political, military, economic, reshaping the Middle East and Africa at the same time. And like every shift in regional power, its consequences eventually land on Palestinian lives. Analysts describe Turkey's latest move as a strategic shockwave. Ankara publicly challenged Israeli policy, criticized its regional behavior, and signaled that Israel's actions are destabilizing global alliances. This was not symbolic rhetoric. It was a calculated message aimed at Washington, Brussels, and Tel Aviv. Turkey's position reflects several realities. Growing frustration with Israel's regional conduct. A desire to reposition itself as a stabilizing force in the Muslim world. A strategic pivot toward African and Middle Eastern partnerships. A warning that Israel's behavior is undermining Western credibility. For Washington, this was unexpected. Turkey is a NATO member, a long-standing US partner, and a regional heavyweight. Its criticism carries weight and consequences. Inside Washington, analysts say the reaction was a mix of surprise and discomfort. For years, US officials have privately debated Israel's strategic value versus its political cost. Now, Turkey's public stance forced those conversations into the open. Some American analysts argue that Israel's actions, from regional escalation to domestic political turmoil, have made it harder for Washington to maintain global alliances. Others warn that Israel's confrontational posture risks dragging the US into conflicts it does not want. The phrase, a burden on the world, did not originate in Washington, but it reflects a sentiment some policymakers have quietly expressed. Israel's current trajectory is creating more instability than deterrence. This is not a break in the alliance. It is a moment of reckoning. While Turkey and the US navigate diplomatic shockwaves, Saudi Arabia is reshaping the Horn of Africa with deliberate precision. Analysts describe Riyadh's strategy as regional engineering, a long-term plan to stabilize the Red Sea corridor, secure trade routes, and build influence across Sudan, Ethiopia, Eritrea, Djibouti, and Somalia. Saudi Arabia's moves include mediating regional disputes to prevent wars that threaten Red Sea security, investing in ports and infrastructure to control maritime trade, building alliances with African governments seeking stability and economic support, positioning itself as the central power in Red Sea geopolitics. This strategy is not about charity. It is about leverage, economic, political, and strategic. And it is changing the balance of power across East Africa. The Horn of Africa is not a distant region. It is a crossroads of global trade, migration, and military strategy. Whoever shapes the Horn shapes. Red Sea security, global shipping routes, energy corridors, regional alliances, access to Africa's emerging markets. Saudi Arabia understands this. Turkey understands this. Israel understands this. Washington understands this. And Palestinians, though far from the Red Sea, are affected by every shift in these alliances. As Turkey criticizes Israel and Saudi Arabia expands its influence, Israel finds itself increasingly isolated. Analysts point to several factors. Regional frustration with Israeli escalation, declining diplomatic leverage in Africa and the Middle East, growing skepticism in Washington about Israel's strategic value, competition from Turkey and Saudi Arabia for regional leadership. Israel's attempts to maintain dominance through military signaling are clashing with a new regional reality. Power is shifting toward states that prioritize stability, economic influence, and long-term strategy. Israel's reliance on force is becoming less effective in a region moving toward diplomacy and economic leverage. The phrase, Israel is a burden on the world, is not a slogan. It is a reflection of growing international frustration. Analysts highlight several concerns. Escalations that threaten global markets, conflicts that draw in major powers, policies that undermine regional stability, diplomatic crises that complicate alliances. This narrative is gaining traction not because of ideology, but because of consequences. Israel's actions are increasingly seen as destabilizing, not only for Palestinians, but for the entire region. For Palestinians, these regional shifts carry profound implications. Turkey's criticism of Israel strengthens international calls for accountability. Saudi Arabia's influence in the Horn of Africa reshapes regional alliances that could support Palestinian diplomacy. Washington's discomfort signals a potential shift in how the US manages Israeli escalation. But the most important impact is psychological. For decades, Palestinians have watched Israel act with impunity. Now, major regional powers are openly challenging that behavior. This does not guarantee change, but it opens a door. The Middle East and Africa are undergoing a transformation. Turkey is asserting itself as a global diplomatic actor. Saudi Arabia is engineering a new Red Sea order. The US is reassessing its alliances. Israel is facing unprecedented criticism. African states are gaining strategic importance. This is not a temporary shift. It is a new regional architecture. And Palestinians, long marginalized in global politics, may find new opportunities in this emerging landscape. Today, as Turkey delivers a diplomatic slap, as Washington absorbs the shock, and as Saudi Arabia rewrites the Horn of Africa, one truth becomes clear. The region is changing. Power is moving. Alliances are evolving. And Israel, once untouchable, is now being questioned, openly, loudly, and by states that shape global strategy. For Palestinians, this moment is not a guarantee. But it is a reminder that regional dynamics are not fixed. They can shift. They can open space. They can create new paths toward justice and accountability. This is not a story of collapse. It is a story of recalibration and the possibility that a new regional order may finally recognize the cost of ignoring Palestine. I'm James Kent, and you are listening to This Week in Palestine, Truth and Justice Radio, WZBC Boston College. Now let's begin with a moment that exposes how power behaves when it believes consequences are optional. Donald Trump, facing allegations that stretch from a Qatari private jet to a mysterious crypto windfall, shrugs off every scandal as if accountability were an outdated concept. Not with denial, not with outrage, but with indifference, the kind that signals confidence in a system that rarely punishes the powerful. Should we begin with that Qatari jet that raised questions about access, influence, and the quiet corridors where foreign governments try to shape American decisions? A jet that became less about luxury and more about the ease with which global actors reach into Washington? Or should we begin with a crypto windfall that appeared out of nowhere, wrapped in digital opacity, feeding concerns about untraceable money flowing toward political figures who shape global policy? A windfall that highlights how modern corruption doesn't need envelopes or briefcases, just a blockchain. Another way to begin is with Washington pretending these scandals are noise, even as analysts warn they reveal a deeper vulnerability. A political system where foreign access is negotiable, oversight is inconsistent, and influence travels faster than truth. Or maybe we should begin with the uncomfortable reality that every shift in Washington's integrity eventually reaches the Middle East. Because when American policy is shaped by opaque relationships, Palestinians feel the consequences long before the headlines fade. Or we can begin with a question that matters today. What happens when the world's most powerful office treats corruption not as a threat, but as background static? Or we should begin with the possibility that these scandals are not isolated stories. but signals of how global power truly operates. Let's begin with the truth that ignoring corruption doesn't make it disappear. It makes it stronger. Let's examine the story unfolding far from the Middle East, yet shaping it in ways many people never notice. A story about power, influence, and the ease with which political scandals are dismissed when the stakes are global. A story about Donald Trump brushing off corruption allegations, from a Qatari private jet controversy to a mysterious crypto windfall, and how these moments ripple across Washington, the Gulf, and ultimately Palestine. This is not a story of guilt or innocence. It is a story of how political systems respond to pressure, how leaders navigate scandal, and how the consequences of those choices travel across borders. According to multiple analysts and media reports, one of the scandals surrounding Trump involved the use of a luxury jet linked to Qatari interests. The details vary depending on the source, but the core allegation is simple. A foreign government or its affiliates provided access to a private aircraft, raising questions about influence, favors, and political entanglements. Critics argue that such arrangements blur the line between diplomacy and personal benefit. Supporters dismiss the controversy as political theater. But the significance lies not in the jet itself. It lies in what it represents: foreign access to American power, the ease of informal influence channels, the normalization of blurred boundaries between state and personal interests, even Washington. This was another reminder that global politics often unfold in private cabins, not public chambers. Another controversy emerged around a sudden crypto windfall reportedly connected to Trump or his affiliates. The details remain murky, as crypto transactions often do, but analysts highlight several concerns: lack of transparency, potential foreign involvement, regulatory loopholes, the possibility of political figures benefiting from untraceable financial flows. Crypto is not inherently corrupt, but when political figures are involved, questions multiply. Observers warn that digital assets can become tools for influence, pressure, or reward, especially when traditional financial oversight is limited. Trump's response, according to analysts, was predictable. Dismiss the allegations, shift the narrative, move forward. In isolation, a private jet and a crypto windfall may seem like minor controversies, but together, they reveal a pattern analysts often discuss: foreign governments seeking access to US power, political figures navigating opaque financial channels, a global system where influence is traded quietly, not publicly. These scandals matter because they shape how Washington engages with the world. They influence diplomatic decisions, alliances, and regional strategies. And when Washington shifts, the Middle East feels it immediately. The Gulf region, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, plays a central role in American foreign policy. Economic ties, military cooperation, and political influence flow in both directions. When a scandal involves Gulf actors, analysts say it can affect diplomatic negotiations, military coordination, regional alliances, energy policy, U.S. posture toward Iran. Qatar, in particular, has spent years building influence in Washington through diplomacy, investment, and strategic partnerships. Any controversy involving Qatari-linked assets becomes part of a larger conversation about Gulf influence in U.S. politics. Inside Washington, reactions to these scandals were divided. Some policymakers expressed concern about foreign access to American political figures. Others argued that such controversies are common in global politics and rarely lead to meaningful consequences. But analysts highlight a deeper issue. When scandals are dismissed quickly, they create a precedent. A precedent that says influence is negotiable, access is flexible, transparency is optional. This precedent shapes how future leaders behave and how foreign governments attempt to engage them. Scandals involving foreign influence do not stay confined to Washington. they affect U.S. policy toward Iran, military cooperation with Gulf states, diplomatic pressure on Israel, humanitarian decisions affecting Gaza and the West Bank. When political figures are entangled in controversies, their decisions may be influenced, consciously or unconsciously, by relationships formed during those moments. Analysts warn that this can distort policy priorities, weaken oversight, and complicate regional stability. For Palestinians, these scandals may seem distant, but their consequences are not. When Washington's foreign policy is shaped by opaque relationships, Palestinians often feel the impact. Delays in humanitarian aid, shifts in diplomatic pressure on Israel, changes in U.S. engagement with Gulf states, reduced focus on Palestinian rights. Palestinians live at the intersection of global politics they did not choose. When scandals influence Washington's decisions, those decisions influence Palestinian lives. This is the hidden cost of political opacity. Analysts describe the modern political landscape as a system built on influence, not always corruption, but access, relationships, and strategic benefit. The Qatari jet controversy and the crypto windfall are symptoms of a larger reality. Power attracts influence. Influence attracts opportunity. Opportunity attracts risk. This system is not unique to Trump. It is global, but its consequences are felt most strongly in regions where stability is fragile. Today, as Trump shrugs off corruption scandals, from private jets to crypto windfalls, one truth becomes clear. Scandals are not just stories. They are signals. Signals of how power operates, how influence travels, and how decisions are shaped behind closed doors. For Palestinians, these signals matter, because every shift in Washington's political landscape eventually reaches the Middle East, reshaping alliances, priorities, and the fragile balance of regional stability. This was meant to reveal how a man entrusted with the highest office in the nation managed to turn that office into a machine that generated billions, not millions, billions. And he did not do it alone. His family benefited. His wealthy friends benefited. Even some of his political enemies, the ones who paid him, the ones who bought access, the ones who traded loyalty for influence, they benefited too. This is not a story about guilt or innocence. That debate belongs to courts, lawyers, and historians. This is a story about consequence, about what happens when power is left unchecked, about what happens when a leader discovers he can bend the rules, twist the system, and reshape the government to serve himself. This is the cost of ignoring corruption. This is the cost of pretending that authority can't be abused. This is the cost of believing that a president is somehow immune to the temptations that come with absolute power. Because when someone in power realizes they can do whatever they want, when they realize no one will stop them, when they realize the system will bend instead of break, when they realize the public will argue instead of act, then the door opens to everything we fear. Deals made in secret, money flowing through back channels, policies shaped not by national interest, but by personal gain, foreign governments buying influence, corporations buying silence, friends buying protection, enemies buying forgiveness. And the tragedy is not just that it happened. The tragedy is that we allowed it to happen. We watched it unfold in real time. We saw the signs. We heard the warnings. We witnessed the conflicts of interest, the sudden wealth, the unexplained transactions, the favors disguised as diplomacy. We saw it all, and yet, somehow we convinced ourselves that this was normal, that this was politics, that this was just how the game is played. But corruption is not a game. It is a poison, and once it enters the bloodstream of a nation, it spreads. It infects institutions. It erodes trust. It destroys the belief that leadership can be honorable, that government can be fair, that democracy can be real. This story is not about one man, It is about what happens when a nation forgets that power must be held accountable. It is about what happens when we stop demanding integrity from those who lead us. It is about what happens when we allow the presidency, the symbol of our collective voice, to become a marketplace. This is not a story of guilt or innocence. It is a story of consequence. And the consequences are already here. I'm James Kent, and you are listening to This Week in Palestine. And just like that, we arrive at the final breaths of this week's broadcast. The slow dimming of a lantern, the quiet settling of truth after an hour that asked much of the heart. As you step back into your day, may you carry with you the questions that refuse to be buried, the courage that refuses to fade, and the curiosity that keeps truth alive in a world that works tirelessly to silence it. I'm James Kent, your host and narrator. Sharing this hour with you has been an honor. An hour grounded in clarity, in dignity, in a solidarity that does not evaporate when the headlines shift or when the cameras turn away. If something you heard today unsettled you, challenged you, or cracked open a door you didn't know existed, and if you ever feel the pull to lend your own voice to this work, know that this space will always have room for you. You can reach us anytime at twippodcasts@gmail.com. To you, our listeners, thank you. Thank you for your time, your trust, your willingness to walk this difficult path beside us. Your presence is the quiet proof that truth still matters, that memory still matters, that resistance still matters. If you missed any part of today's program, you can find us on every major platform, YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Podcast Index, iHeartRadio, Pocket Casts, Deezer, Overcast, Castro, Podchaser, Castbox, Player FM, Good Pods, and True Fans. You can also explore our full archive on radio4all.net and archive.org. Just search This Week in Palestine or TWIP and look for the image of the little girl raising her hands in the victory sign. We're also featured on Million Podcasts, a platform uplifting Arab American creators and helping listeners discover new voices. Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. We'll return next week. Until then, take care. Stay grounded. Stay steadfast. This is This Week in Palestine. This is Occupied Land. This is Palestine. And the call for freedom continues. Free Palestine from the river to the sea. Philistine Horat. ¶¶